I'm here to discuss the issue of delivery and establishing the credibility of oneself as a speaker. And I think that there are two primary foundations for establishing one's own credibility. First is the issue of critical listening. Most people think about a presentation and think about the way in which they want to deliver, speak, rather than appreciate what the other persons in the debate are saying. And I think a foundation for an effective delivery begins with critical listening skills. One must know the issues involved in a debate before speaking about them. Understanding is the foundation for the delivery that one might present. In addition, one has to express ideas properly. It's important to remember the ideas that have gone before in a debate. And it's critical to direct information to the ideas of an opponent, to the specific language that they use. One must select and employ their language rather than one's own language. And the reason for that is debates are about clash. It's important to promote clash in a debate. The way to do that is to incorporate the rhetoric from the other side, make sure that the judge or audience recognizes the way in which your argument attaches to the presentation from the other side, and then make an effective presentation. That's why listening is so important in establishing the credibility of a speaker, because critical listening allows you to understand the issues, remember them, and express them in the language of the other side. Second foundation is to use delivery to establish your credibility for your own purposes. You don't have standing before an audience until you establish your credibility on the issues that you are going to discuss. And one's credibility is the only ability that one has to hold the attention of the audience. It's the reason that an audience will listen to a speaker, is because that speaker has credibility for that particular audience. Some might say, well, what about the portions of a presentation, or perhaps even an entire presentation, in which one cites evidence or the opinions of experts about an issue? In some respects, this can undermine the credibility of a speaker. That's why it's important to select appropriate information and use expert opinion and other forms of evidence to support one's own good ideas. Otherwise, an audience wonders why the expert isn't called on to deliver the information and what the speaker has to say about an issue. After all, if all your material is contained in a text, any person in the audience who is literate is able to make the same kind of presentation that the speaker is able to make. The way in which a speaker establishes their credibility is going beyond the text. And so it's important to engage in both critical listening and establish one's personal credibility in order to have an effective delivery. There are elements associated with the issue of credibility. You need to capture the attention of an audience. How does one capture the attention of an audience? Well, through the substantive presentation of information. The better researched one is, the better one is able to analyze the key elements associated with a discussion, the more likely it is that an audience will listen to an individual. A presentation should be interesting. It should engage the audience in an effective way. This might happen either by garnering the support of the audience. It's an appeal to the audience to get their support on an issue. And it might motivate the audience. It might present information in a way that calls on the audience to take a strident action in support of the attitude of the speaker. And so these are the goals of the credible speaker. There are some effective techniques associated with establishing one's delivery credibility in a discussion. The first, I think, has to do with establishing one's credibility at the outset of a presentation. In the introduction, it's important to either identify yourself or your qualifications for speaking about an issue. It may be necessary to present some startling factual information to let everyone know that this is an important issue that you're discussing. You might try to connect the experience of the audience to local or regional or national or international events of concern. This includes the audience in the discussion. You might use humor. It's disarming. It is entertaining as a way of including the audience. You might use powerful quotations. Many of the ideas that we would like to express have been better expressed through history. Finally, you might refer to the event itself. If you're before a group to make a public presentation about a particular issue of interest to that group, if you're making a presentation at City Hall arguing about the politics in your city, you might refer to the event itself as a way of mobilizing the audience to pay attention to the information that you will present. In addition to establishing your credibility in the introduction, and if you're unable to establish your credibility there, it's unlikely the audience will maintain its interest in you for you to develop a common bond with the audience at a later point. You want to maintain their interest throughout the duration of a presentation. One can do this with a narrative presentation, an introduction, a body, and conclusion. It is a simple but not simplistic approach to a presentation, a powerful introduction, a body of knowledge that an audience can grasp in the amount of time one is able to make a presentation, and then a conclusion that reaffirms the idea at the outset. The use of humor, which can so effectively engage an audience, the presentation of powerful imagery and innovative ideas and clever language can maintain the interest of an audience. In addition, you want to motivate a response from the audience. This can be done through repetition. This can be done through repetition. You can ask questions of the audience. You can draw on issues of experience that the audience might have or engage in call and response, but you might actually motivate the voices of the audience in a presentation as a way of establishing your credibility. You're not speaking down to them. You're not speaking at them. You are a voice with them. In addition, you can offer effective summaries of the ideas that you've presented. You're not just presenting a series of factoids. They're facts that make a point. And the point is a powerful one. And you want the audience to reach two or three powerful conclusions based on your presentation. Well, then draw those conclusions for them, offer effective summaries of the major ideas that you're advancing, and let an audience or a judge in a competitive event understand those foundations. Finally, you can use nonverbal cues. Eye contact is essential. And the reason that eye contact is essential, one is usually in a public presentation, speaking at a distance from the audience or judge. And yet in everyday communication, one speaks in a relatively close proximity to someone with whom they are conversing, somewhere between 2 and 4 feet. But no one sits down next to all the members of an audience and speaks with them for a public presentation. You are separated by some distance. Perhaps it's as close as 10 or 15 feet, but more likely with a larger audience, it may be dozens or hundreds of feet away from all the participants in a speaking event. And so it's important for individuals to maintain eye contact with those that they are appealing to close the gap, create some intimacy, make people feel comfortable about the way in which someone is presenting information. This is the way in which one can use nonverbal cues to establish their own delivery style, make public presentations, but still have the closeness associated with intimate conversation. Make sure you use gestures. When one uses gestures, that one tries to make sure that the gestures match the information that's being presented and do not present gestures in a random way. One can move if it's possible to do so during a presentation, and also it's interesting to present illustrations or video as a way of supplementing an idea. All of these techniques, credibility in the introduction, maintaining interest throughout, primarily through a narrative presentation, offering summaries, motivating responses from an audience, and having nonverbal persuasive techniques included in a presentation, will enhance the presentation of the speaker, establish their credibility, their trustworthiness, their meaningfulness, their genuineness to an audience, and then the audience is motivated to listen to someone. The speaker is then able to hold their attention for the substantive information that the speaker needs to direct to the audience to motivate them to move in the direction of the opinions of the speaker.
This lecture is on delivery guidelines. The first thing we need to talk about when we start examining debate is that since we need to have a beginning and an end to a debate, we adopt time limits. There's each of the speeches and even the cross-examination periods built into debates have a limited amount of time associated with them. Whether we're talking about speeches that last 9 minutes or speeches that are as brief as 2 minutes, these time limits tend to bracket what can be said in a debate round. And as such, one of the complaints associated with policy debating in the United States has been the speed at which the debaters speak. They speak very quickly, and often to a lay audience, they speak at a speed that is nearly unintelligible. The defense for the quick delivery associated with policy debate tends to occur on a few levels. The first level is that there is excellent research indicating that you can think a lot better and a lot faster than you can actually hear. In other words, there is good evidence in compressed speech indicating that you can compress lectures, give them at a rather quick pace, and in response, students still have a high level of retention. In other words, we're taught to listen at a slow pace, and we can change that pacing quite easily. Indeed, there are some graduate and medical schools around the United States that have taped many of the lectures, and students listen to the lectures at a quickened replay speed and are able to retain the information. Some literature even suggests they retain more. The second defense associated with the amount of speed associated with debate is the think fast approach to debate. That what policy debating does is teach students to think fast. You can always teach someone to speak slower, but it's very difficult to teach someone to think faster. And what academic debates does with the time limits and the increased clip of presentation is it teaches how to students to think very quickly in debate rounds in order to remain competitive. This is not to say that this quick form of delivery is appropriate. It's important to understand that even though there are time limits, we need to adjust the delivery appropriately to the audience and the critic in the debate we may be in, or for the audience if it tends to be a public debate. And adjusting the speed of the presentation needs to be done in order to maintain a sufficient level of comprehensibility with the audience. It's suggested, for example, that when you are speaking with an audience, you want to speak at a clip which is sufficiently quick that it requires them to attend to what is being said in order to fully comprehend and retain the information. In other words, you want to speak at a level a little quicker than you would in normal speech. The second major area I want to mention are the variables associated with delivery. And this has to do with a few things. First, the subject of debates often decide on the type of delivery that a debater wants for an argument. Some subjects are incredibly dense. They are so dense, for that matter, that what ends up happening is that the material is lost if the speaker speaks at a rapid clip. For example, if we start talking about neo-Marxism and neo-Marxist theories and, in for example, legal reasoning, this is not the type of subject matter that we need to present at breakneck speed. We need to take our time. We need to make sure that the audience is actually understanding this rather dense material and maybe even retaining some of it. The second variable is the setting. Some physical settings are just not amenable to quick presentations because of the weak and if not incredibly detrimental acoustics in the room. You may find that your voice is rattled across the room and throughout the room as you're speaking, in which case you're going to have to make appropriate adjustments in the presentation. Also, in terms of how the audience is set up, whether they are looking at you, whether the configuration of the room allows them to hear you, as well as how dense the audience is, and how many people are in the room, and how you want to approach it. For a small audience, it's much more desirable, obviously, to have a much more intimate type of presentation than you would in a more formal audience, which would be larger. Also, the last variable to present in terms of delivery is what the purpose of the speech is. If the purpose of the speech is a speech to inform, then we can normally increase the rate of the presentation, and when we get to technical information, we can adjust it appropriately. If it's a speech to persuade, again, when we get to the parts of the speech which are the grist of the persuasion, the main rationale for the arguments we're presenting, we will also want to adjust the presentation as well. The third major thing I want to mention in terms of delivery guidelines has to do with delivery drills. I teach public speaking and business professional speaking and a slew of other courses that are technical in nature. And I often have to discuss with my students that delivery is something that you learn, and you need to exercise the muscles associated with producing clear tones and to articulate and make sure that you enunciate all the words. So there's a whole series of delivery drills that are available. Drills like reading sentences as quickly and clearly as possible. Reading sentences where you read the word from beginning to end, but you start at the end of the sentence reading the last word first, the second to the last word second, and the third of the last word third, etc. And as such, you provide a nonsense list of words, but you focus on the articulation and the enunciation. And there's many others, for example, where you throw a vowel between the words, so it forces you to bite into the words, enunciate, and articulate. The next remark I want to make about delivery deals with you need to deliver an argument to recall. In other words, we want the audience to actually recall what we're saying. As such, we need to number the arguments, or we need to find a way to indicate to the audience that you have completed one argument, you're moving to another sub-argument and such. We can do this through a numbering system, and numbers tend to work quite well. We also can do it through taglining our arguments. In other words, provide a synopsis of what the argument is in a brief, short, often incomplete sentence, but a tag that the audience can then recall. Last, as we're reading through evidence in a debate round and we come to parts of the evidence which are particularly important, we might want to accentuate the presentation at that point. We might want to speak louder and clearer at that point. So you want to deliver the material in order for the audience to recall the material well. There are time limits. You're right, people talk quickly, and there's a defense for that, but you need to adjust it. Remember those variables, the subject and the setting and the purpose of the debate will affect its delivery as well. Engage these delivery drills and learn to speak clearly and articulate and enunciate well, and deliver your arguments so they can be recalled. Finally, in terms of delivery, is be yourself as a speaker. Don't engage a persona, the debater persona, that you would use in a policy debate. Instead, just be yourself. Speak as if you were speaking to a group of two or three when you're speaking to a group of 100 or more. And that provides an intimacy that is always going to work to your advantage. Thank you.
I want to catalog some of the basic elements of your public speaking delivery and talk about how you can use some of these basic concepts. Now, the basic concepts and ideas that you want to vary your delivery techniques, you don't want to do the same thing all the time, that you want to use emphasis so that it highlights and improves your message, and that you want to remain natural in your delivery at all times. These general concepts can be applied to the various elements that we have that are part of public speaking delivery. And we start with the voice. Now, there are several things that you can do to your voice to try to utilize these concepts. Let's start with volume. Well, I think you want to vary your voice volume. You don't want to speak at the same volume all the time. Anytime you do the same thing over and over again, it becomes boring. It becomes monotone. So you want to vary your voice volume. You want to speak a little louder for issues that are extremely important. And for those issues that are not as important, you might not speak as loudly. But at the same time, you should remember that it's possible to emphasize ideas even by talking softly. But if you ever try to emphasize ideas by talking softly, make sure you pause just for a moment before you switch in to the lower volume. At all times, remember to speak loudly enough so the person farthest away enough in the room will be able to hear you. Then you have your voice tone. You want to emphasize different parts of your speech with different voice tones. For a little tighter, higher pitch, higher tone, more strained, indicates that you're more excited, that you're more energetic, that you're more worked up about something. And if your voice is less tight and a little lower tone, then it's thought that you're extremely relaxed and everything's fine. So you convey different kinds of ideas with your voice tone. You want to vary the tone of your voice so that it fits with the particular message that you're giving at that point. The critical thing is to use your voice for emphasis. Speed of delivery is another issue. How fast should you use your voice? Well, you might want to talk a bit slower with things that are very important. On the other hand, if there are various details that are just part of the basic argument that you're presenting, and the audience probably won't remember all those details anyway, then you probably can talk about it a bit more quickly. As you can tell in this talk, I'm trying to use the techniques that I'm focusing on to illustrate them during this particular talk. And if that seems a bit strange, it's because I'm emphasizing something not to do. For example, you wouldn't use your voice in an unnatural way, in a very sort of nasally, right? That doesn't sound, if you talk like that normally, that might be fine, but don't try to use your voice in an unnatural way. If you want to broaden the spectrum and ability to use your voice at different levels with different qualities, do that in training and do it a little bit at a time. Never be too extreme. Let's talk about gestures now. Let's talk about gestures. Now, generally, gestures involve the use of the hands. Now, most of us have a certain gestural vocabulary. When we talk to other people in informal situations, we use our hands. It just happens. However, for some reason, when people stand up and start giving a public speech, their nerves or whatever overcomes them and they don't use gestures at all, which makes the speech seem very flat. Listeners are used to having people use gestures, to use their hands when they talk. Of course, you don't want to do it too much and be too distracting, but you do want it to seem natural. And if you seem flat and boring, it could be that you're not using the kind of gestures that you normally use in conversation. You want to make sure that gestures are not distracting. One way in which gestures can be distracting is if you do the same thing over and over again. If you have pattern gestures, they become fairly monotonic. And they're not very impressive. And they actually begin to distract the audience because the audience wonders, why is he going like that all the time? Or that's weird. Or what's wrong with him? Or the audience is so easily distracted that you don't want to do anything physically that will distract them. That's why your gestures need to be integrated into your message. You use a gesture when you're making an important point, when you are creating a specific distinction, when you are indicating that you're raising up or rejecting. But you don't want to use them in unusual ways. If you were saying that taxes needed to be lowered, you wouldn't raise your hands. That doesn't mean that you would necessarily want to make a big show out of acting out your message. You don't want to overdo it. Don't say, taxes need to be lowered, because that's too obvious too sophomoric and you're acting out your message. You want the gestures to complement your message. Many of us have gestural vocabularies, things that different gestures we use for different kinds of ideas. I, for example, have gestures that I will use when I'm making an important point. I will have gestures that I will use when I'm explaining. I'm sort of welcoming the audience into this space where this idea is. Now, when I'm making a particular fine distinction between one idea or one concept and another, I'll often grip my fingers and say, there's a fine difference between a republic and a democracy, for example. And that's the gesture I use for that. In competitive debate situations, I might use gestures of inclusion, gestures of exclusion. I might have gestures of rejecting the arguments of my opponents. If I'm accusing my opponents of doing something particularly heinous or wrong, I might point at them. If I am having, you know, a particular inclusionary element with the audience, I might point at them. However, you need to be very careful about pointing at people that you're trying to persuade, because generally you get pointed at in sort of negative situations. Someone scolding you, or you've done something wrong. Bad dog. So you want to be very careful about pointing at anyone or waving your finger at anyone. And of course, we know that gestures are culturally specific. You need to be aware of the gestures that work in your culture, and if you're speaking to people of different cultures, you need to be aware that some gestures might not be appropriate. But don't think that all gestures mean the same thing. Make sure that you know what they are before you're using some of them. Your face is another important part of your delivery, and I think your eyes are fairly important. I think you want to look at the audience. There is a subconscious concept, something that people feel, that if you are looking them in the eye, you're somehow telling them the truth. There's an old expression, look me in the eye and say that, as if it's more difficult to lie when you're looking someone right in the eye. Make sure that you do that to your audience, because I don't think that's necessarily true. You can be a skillful liar and look someone right in the eye. It is effective with the audience to look at them, to try to show them that you can make contact with them. Try, for example, to find different parts of the audience and look at them directly for a moment, to make eye contact with some of them there. That can be very meaningful for them and make your message more effective. Some facial expressions that you have should not in any way conflict with the message that you're trying to present. If you're very sure about something, then you wouldn't want to look worried and concerned. If you were happy, you wouldn't want to look unhappy. Likewise, if you were pained or concerned about something, you wouldn't want to be smiling. Don't worry about choreographing your face. Make sure, though, that your face doesn't present a conflicting message. Last thing I want to talk about is movement and posture. I can't go too far off camera here on the set, but I do want to indicate that it's good for you to move around during your speech. Now, patterned repetitive motions can be very, very bad. They're very distracting. The audience starts feeling seasick, so don't have any kind of patterned motions. Don't play with keys or things that you have in your pocket. Don't play with a pen while you speak. That's a bad kind of motion. But you might want to move to some spot, from that spot, talk about a specific idea, focus on a given part of the audience, and then for another idea, move to another spot, focus on a different part of the audience for that idea, but move around for major portions of your talk, not randomly. Use it to emphasize your content. So, these are the basic tools that you have for delivering a speech. Your voice, your gestures, your face, your body movement. Try to use them to indicate, to give your audience a varied presentation that's not monotonous, that you use to emphasize your message and yet keeps within your natural range, and you'll be an excellent public speaker.
Hello. I'm here to discuss the issue of anxiety in public speaking. And I'll say at the outset that almost everyone has anxiety or elements of fear whenever they're engaged in public speaking. It's simply that seasoned practitioners engage in a significant number of public speaking experiences, develop some confidence about their presentation, and are able to make consistent presentations with minimal fear or anxiety associated with the event. And so it is a constant issue associated with public speaking. It doesn't mean it needs to inhibit one's participation in public speaking events. At the outset, let me simply say that the overwhelming majority of individuals are fearful of public speaking. There have been surveys conducted for decades indicating that as many as 80% of individuals in the general public have as a major concern their ability to participate in any kind of public debate or discussion. That doesn't mean one should avoid public speaking, and in many circumstances, one can't avoid public speaking. One could, in fact, use the anxiety associated with public speaking. Actually, it physically brings a lot of adrenaline into the system. One could bring some drama or passion or energy to a presentation because of anxiety associated with a public speaking event. This was one of the criticisms of Vice President Al Gore during his unsuccessful campaign for the presidency of the United States in 2000. And the issue for Gore was that he was so comfortable as a public speaker that he came off as robotic and stiff, that he didn't bring the kind of frantic energy that one might use to excite an audience. And so it's possible to use one's anxiety associated with public speaking, but I'm really here to give three basic guidelines associated with anxiety reduction. Anxiety reduction in public speaking. And the first, I think, is an obvious one, and I'll explain this one in great detail, and that's the issue of preparation. Preparation. There are elements associated with preparation that significantly reduce the anxiety that one might have, or nervous condition, or fear associated with public speaking. Research the topic that one is going to present, and do so in a serious way, both through traditional sources as well as electronic materials. Analyze the issues carefully and practice one's delivery, both for yourself as well as for small groups. And so this is what's involved with substantive presentation and preparation for the same. One should understand the topic, they should have clearly analyzed the issues, and they should have practiced those issues. That provides you with confidence in the way in which one would present information, and you're able then to focus on the message of a talk rather than the anxiety associated with a presentation. In addition, preparation means one should learn the audience. One should learn the audience. It's important to identify the audience for an event in advance. If possible, research the background of individuals in an audience. Here I'm not talking about a privacy invasion of members of the audience, but for many public speaking events, they are designed for groups of individuals or groups of students. It's possible to know whether or not those who will be in the audience, the majority of them, what their expectations are for the presentation. And so one has information that can be used to understand the audience and anticipate the reaction of the audience. This is really the foundation for nervousness associated with public speaking. An individual is making a presentation, to an audience and they don't know how the audience will react. Well, the more you learn about the audience, the more likely it is you'll be able to anticipate the reaction of the audience and then build into a presentation the kind of information that will appeal to that audience, so that when you anticipate the reaction of the audience, it will be a favorable one rather than an unfavorable one. And part of the way in which one can prepare for an event is to visualize a successful presentation. And so if one prepares in substance, learns the audience, and is able to anticipate both the speech and the audience reaction, then you're able to visualize a successful presentation of one's performance. When you're able to do that, you are able to develop the confidence that's necessary to carry out the task at hand. The second issue, relaxation techniques. And visualization is a relaxation technique, but in addition, breathing physically calms an individual prior to a presentation. It's important for one to take several deep breaths. Inhale through your nose, exhale subtly through your mouth, fill your lungs with air, and this will present the opportunity for you to compose yourself and relax prior to the delivery of information. Third, an effective introduction is the most important element of a speech in order to reduce anxiety. An effective introduction. Well, why an effective introduction? First, it has a calming effect on the speaker. The reason? Because once you are able to get the attention of an audience, move the audience subtly in a direction that you think is valuable, then you meet the expectations that you've established in your visualization of a successful event, and you get the ball rolling. And so the effectiveness of one's introduction can actually produce a calming effect for an entire presentation. Second thing to include in an introduction, humor. Humor is essential in an effective introduction to a presentation. And this calms the audience, gets the audience involved in the presentation with the speaker. And so it's also a possibility, if one doesn't have extemporaneous humor skills, it's also a possibility for someone to prepare humor in advance and include that in a powerful, attention-getting, and engaging presentation. That piques the interest of the audience and gets them involved in the presentation, making it easier for someone to mark an effective delivery.